could we start off with your father, who, you know, in the RLT? Would that be a good idea?
Yes, well, you see, I'm the eldest of 11. My father was a tailor and cutter, therefore a craftsman. But he joined the ILP, which was formed in 1893, the year I was born, and was one of the earlier members in Glasgow of the ILP, which became very strong there. When they set up socialist Sunday schools, although I attended the religious Sunday schools because my mother wouldn't have liked us to do anything different. Dad wanted us to go to the socialist Sunday school. He wasn't against us going to the religious Sunday school, but he wanted us to have something to set off against it. So we all attended the socialist Sunday school when we were children. And so we got indoctrinated, as the anti-Marxist people say. I grew up with this idea that, because my father practiced what he preached, and this is the point, he was a good socialist in every sense of the word. If a beggar came to our place on a Sunday when we were all sat down to dinner, he'd bring that beggar in. He'd sit him down at the table, he'd take a clean plate and he'd take something off all our plates and put it in front of the beggar. And then he'd share with us the meal that we had and a cup of tea afterwards. And then when he went out, Dad would give him a penny or tuppence, which was quite a bit in those days. You know, it meant a lot, because for tuppence you could get a bed in the model lodging house. And then when the man had gone, he'd say to us, "Now you perhaps understand what I mean when I say, one can't help many, but many can help one." That was his object lesson. And I know that on another occasion, there was an Irish labourer who fell ill, and of course in those days they didn't do anything much for them. They had to go to the poor law, and they didn't help him very much either. And he had five children, and my father on the Saturday, when he was finished, well, they finished about 12:30 or so, after he'd had his dinner, he went out with a bag all down our long street, a very long street, three stories in every building, three houses on every landing, right to the length of the street and back again, and he collected over £5 in pennies and things like that, took them right over to this poor woman, and he says, "That'll keep you going, Mrs. Mooney, for a week or so anyway. Perhaps your husband will be better." And she says, "Well, I'm a Catholic and you're a Protestant, yet you do that." My father says, "No, I'm not Catholic or Protestant, I'm a socialist." He says, "And I'm doing it because we should all help one another when we're in trouble." And that woman was crying because somebody had come to her assistance without her even knowing that such help was coming.
It's very interesting because one feels that socialists nowadays, it's a thing you vote for, but it's not something that influences your life.
Oh,
you know what I mean?
Oh,
whereas
no.
Your father, you, being a socialist, really meant behaving differently from other people in the day-to-day life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And if he was in his tram car and there was a woman there with a baby crying its head off, he'd go up and say, "Madam, let me hold your baby," because he had a way with children. And she'd look at him, perhaps gaping a bit, but generally his face gave him enough confidence that he gave the baby. And you know, in 5 minutes, that baby would be laughing and gurgling and pulling his moustache. He had that baby. He was the same at home. He could always make babies laugh.
That's a remarkable character.
Yeah, he was.
What made him a socialist, actually, do you think?
Well, he came from the north of Scotland, Wick, you know, in the John O'Groats way. And, you know, up there, they had terrible treatment. They had a very strong Highland Land League up there. Because these people were coming in and burning crofts while the men were at the Crimean War, you see, and when they came home, their families had been dispersed, they couldn't find them, and this has...
So was he driven out into the big city?
Yes, that's right, this is right. There are hundreds of them were driven out into the big cities. And of course, that as it still remains at a point where even the Scottish nationalists say talk about that. That happened, nearly 200 years ago now, mm-hmm. but they still talk about it. But as you say, the idea of living socialism is something that was inculcated in me by my father's own conduct.
Was he an educated man, do you think? He was sort of self-educated, wasn't he?
He was self-educated because he left school when he was 8, but he was one of the best read men. I met a lot of them in the working classes, miners, dockers and so on, railwaymen, who had big collections. But he introduced me to the rationalist press. You know, they used to...
Oh, yes, the anti-religious.
You'd got Paine and Haeckel and all those things. Before I'd reached my teens, he used to buy them regularly. And he even gave me Darwin's Origin of Species before I was 14. Well, I didn't understand it then, but later on when I did go, I realized what he was trying to teach me or for me to learn. He was a very well-read man, and he got all the modern progressive publications.
He had books of his own in the house.
Yes, we'd always piles of books there, and I was very fond of reading. In fact, I once nearly got run down because I was reading as I went along the street. I went into the road without looking and nearly run down by a horse and cart. So I was just as keen on reading as he was. But because of this interest, as you see, all of us were more or less, if I may use that very much abused word, indoctrinated when we were very young. And I've always, my father's example has really been part of my life too. I think if you believe in something, you should act as if you believed in it. Yeah. And when I've been offered jobs at big sums, big salaries, I've refused them because they violated my ideas of what I stood for as a socialist. 3 times I've done that, both here and in the USA when I've been over there.
But you said all of us, so you had brothers and sisters.
Well, I had 6 brothers and 4 sisters. All my brothers, except one who is in America, have died, but because we're all getting on now. But all my 4 sisters are alive. In fact, I had one of them here with her husband last week.
Oh.
So I had a lovely time. But we've always been a closely knit family and always affectionate one towards the other. We've never, we had our childish quarrels, but when we grew up, we did respect one another, and we were very fond of one another. And this is why I don't understand these appeals on the BBC for, with an appeal for some son or daughter who hasn't...
Yes, they always surprise me too, who hasn't been seen for 5 years.
5 years, that's right. I don't understand that, because we kept in close touch with one another and with our parents, and we still do. Mm. Although we're all on the phone now, so we can phone one another, although all my sisters except one is in Scotland.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
So, were you the eldest then, Stephen?
Yes, I was the eldest.
The eldest child,
yes.
Were you really? Older than all your brothers and sisters?
Over all my brothers and sisters.
Were you really?
Yeah.
Yes.
So I didn't have much playtime. See, not that it worried me, because I've always been fond of children. And
So you had to look after the other?
I had to look after them until I went into service when I was about 15, I think.
Mm. May I ask you when you were born? You may not want to tell
1893.
Me. I see, because some
I'm 84 now.
They'd like to be asked.
Yes.
So really, you're really an Edwardian in your upbringing.
Absolutely. And of course, most of the early socialists were Christians. You know, they were members of the church, and most of them were. If you went to Durham, you'd find a lot of them were local preachers. And same in Scotland, they were very strict teetotalers. Most of the socialists.
But your father was a secularist, actually, was he?
Yes, he was.
He wasn't even nonconformist.
No, he wasn't nonconformist. He used to go to church with Mother just because she liked him to go with her, but...
He didn't really believe in
it. No, he never really believed in that. But Mother did. She was quite keen on our church.
What church was it actually?
Oh, well, it was Presbyterian.
Was it?
Yeah.
Not UP, not United.
No. This is in the days when they were really Church of Scotland, actually.
Yes. Yes.
And of course, there's been several splinter groups since that day, as there is in the Methodist Church and other churches.
Yes. But you haven't told me yet what your father did for a living.
Oh, he was a tailor and cutter.
Was it with a small shop or a workshop?
He had his own, when we were young, in Edinburgh. We moved to Glasgow later on after the fourth child was born. He had his own business there, but he didn't have capital much, and he was building up quite a good business. He'd actually 12 men working for him at one time. But he was working for professionals, bankers, doctors, people. Well, they used to leave it for 12 months, pay the bill for 12 months, and then order another suit or coat or something else, you see.
You had to have a lot of working capital.
You need a lot of working capital. So eventually he had to give it up. It was just no good. He had a brother in with him, but he wasn't much use. He insisted on having his £3 out of the business, whether it was there or not, which meant that mother often had to go and pawn her wedding ring to get us children something for the weekend.
So he was a skilled tradesman?
Oh, he was absolutely skilled. Oh, yes. Well, at one time he was in London in Savile Row working there.
Training up, you mean, to be a...
Yes, and he even did embroidery on the Prince of Wales' fancy waistcoats, which that was the King Edward VII, of course, when he was Prince of Wales. And so when he came back to Scotland, he had all this expertise in the high-class tailoring, you see. And the curious thing was, if somebody brought a suit length to him, which is of cheap material, he wouldn't make it up. He says, it won't last. He says, I'd put the work in and I'll charge you for my work, but you won't get the value that you ought to have. But
He
was a real craftsman. He wouldn't take inferior work or inferior cloth to make up, because, as he said, it neither paid the purchaser, the customer, nor the man who made up the cloth. He was very strict about that. And I can remember when I was a candidate in Portsmouth that some of our women were sneering at the Tory women with their fur coats and so on. And one of them said, it's all very good. You're talking about our fur coats and fancy hats. I said, well, your candidate doesn't wear suits that you can pick up at Marks and Spencer's. Oh, well, it wasn't Marks and Spencer's then, it was some other firm. Which was true, because I had a tailored costume which my dad made me. and it really was well made, you see. So they had their comeback there. But I never, until my father died, I never wore anything else but tailored suits and overcoats.
What was he like as a father, actually, Stephen?
Oh, he was very fond of his children. He had a very quick temper, but it was all over in less than 5 minutes. He was really a kind man, really kind.
And was he strict with you?
He was strict. Of course he was strict, because he didn't want us to learn bad manners. In fact, I'm always grateful to him, because he wouldn't let us use the Glasgow vernacular, which is very ugly. He made us speak correct English. Well, if you go up the north of Scotland, you'll find that they do speak correct English. Mm. They may have a sort of soft accent, but it's correct English just the same. Mm. But in Glasgow, they've got a terrible argot.
Real twang, too.
Oh, yes, a sing-song, too. he wouldn't let us do it, you see. And I'm grateful to him, because first time I spoke in the open air in London, a man came up to me and said, well, Miss Stephen, I've enjoyed your speech, and I must compliment you on being the first civilised Scot I've ever listened to.
Well, do you think he wanted his children to get on then? Was that?
Oh, yes. Well, every one of them had a trade, you see. I was destined to be a school teacher, you see, because I had a scholarship before I left school. But because trade was so bad that particular year, I had to go out to work, and I thought, well, I went to one or two jobs, factory jobs, but it was only half a crown a week, and I wasn't helping Mother. So I said, I'll find a job in service, because at any rate, the money will be completely free of any expense to Mother. And of course, you have your board and lodging. Mind you, it wasn't too good in those days, but still, I thought
that
was...
So you went into domestic service?
I went into domestic service, and...
Because it wasn't well paid, was it?
Oh, it was average. For my age then, it was average 10 shillings, but I asked for more. I got 16. Because they could see, obviously, that I had some education and... Yeah. You can't disguise it. I was a student teacher when I had to leave, you see, pupil teacher.
Tell me about your education, Stephen. Could I ask you? I mean, you went to primary school, I suppose,
oh,
first.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Till what, the age of 13 or so?
Well, I went up into what we called the secondary when I was about 12.
Yes.
That's the highest grade, you see, the top grade.
All this in Glasgow, was it?
All this in Glasgow.
Yes.
Well, it was really what we would call today a comprehensive school, because you went right from the infants through the junior right up to the secondary, or what might be called the grammar school stream.
Yes.
So I had a very... In fact, my teachers were very kind to me. One of them especially, when I got to what we called the fifth standard, she used to keep me behind for half an hour nearly every night, although I had to go out and deliver papers, you know. But that wasn't while I was in service, of course. That was when I was still at school.
Mm.
And she gave me a lot of extra coaching. And then when the exams came, I passed them successfully. And I jumped two classes, went straight up into this top stream in the school. So I jumped two classes, and I had a... very good training there. We had a good English master, and French and German. I was always top marks for them. I was really keen about languages, although I've had to drop it in the later part of my life, because you have to practice, you see.
Yes, of course, yeah.
But I'm still interested. I've had books on German, Russian, Dutch, Welsh, Spanish.
Really?
Well, I took a Spanish course, really, a gramophone course.
Because you could do that more easily if you can't see. I
That's
suppose.
Right. Yes. Oh, wow. But the one thing that I couldn't, I really hated, was geometry. I simply couldn't.
Same
stick.
Here. I was just the same.
Yes, and the headmaster said, "I can't understand you, Jesse." He says, "You're top of the class for all your other subjects, and yet." Look at you, 50 out of 100 for geometry. I says, well, I hate it.
Yeah.
He says, well, you're pulling down your aggregate. I says, I still can't get interested.
No,
I says, it doesn't appeal to me.
It's interesting. It's the way your brain's made, I think.
Yes, I think so.
You can't do anything about it, really.
Anyway, I'm grateful to my dad, who cried a bit when I said I was going into... He didn't want me to go into... He wanted something better for me. And, of course, in later years, I justified his appreciation of what I had
so
left.
So how old were you actually when you left school, Miss Stephen?
15.
Were you? I
see. Yes, you see, I wouldn't have been at school as long as that, but for the scholarship or bursary.
Yes.
See, they paid all your books, and there was a sum of £15 which went straight to Mother. No deduction, you see. Everything was paid for.
So they were going to get you into school teaching if you'd had the money, or if you'd been able to carry on.
If I'd been able to carry on, yes. And I would have liked that, because I'm fond of teaching. I've got groups of girls here from the Hartcliffe School. I had about 14 of them a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
They wanted to know about the women's movement, you see,
yes,
their primary information.
Yes.
And they brought their recorder with them. Recorder, you know what I mean.
Yes.
Tape recorder.
Yes.
And they asked questions which were very intelligent. I was delighted when they were only about 14, I think.
They're bright children.
Very bright. I love talking to children like that because their questions are really very much to the point. They don't ask you stupid questions like some reporters from the BBC do.
But one person you haven't mentioned so far is your mother.
Oh, well, mother, of course, she was she had so much to do. I was a great help to her because I used to clean the grate or wash the floor in my lunch hour when from school. And mother and I were very close together over the years. In fact, I always, when I was away from home, I always wrote her twice a week. She used to look forward to those. They were both loving parents, you see. All of us loved our mother and our dad. My mother, of course, wasn't so political as dad, you see. But I must tell you of an incident which took place during the First World War. The brother next to me was a conscientious objector. Of course, being an ILP, I was also a pacifist. My dad was. And this brother, of course, I conducted his defence at the court-martial, which was held just outside Edinburgh. And he was, you got 6 months in Wormwood Scrubs. Well, the Bible woman at the church came up to see mother, and she says, "Aren't you ashamed of those Alec and Jessies? They're not helping their country at all. In fact, they're helping the Germans." Of course, this was the pro-German business, if you were a pacifist. Anyway, mother was so annoyed about this, because you know what mothers are if their children are attacked, even if they don't always accept their point of view. Well, mother did in this case. She said, "I'm not ashamed of them, I'm proud of them. They're acting exactly as their father has taught them to act." She says, "So I don't want you to say any more about it." She says, I love my children, and I'm very proud of those two because of the stand they've taken on this war." Well, it was May Day soon after that, and mother, for the first time in her life, went out in a May Day demonstration with her little pennant, you know, one of those three-cornered flags. She'd never done it before in her life, but she was so angry she went out.
So she actually went out on the demonstration then?
And she went to others after that, but that was the first time she'd ever... And she used to say to me, Dad, you know, if you weren't helping other people with your politics and your trade unionism, you'd be able to do better for yourselves. But of course, this is not our creed anyway. And Dad used to say, "Never mind, Jeannie," he says, "apples will grow again." And this is always his answer. He says, always the act, optimist.
I mean, God will provide in a way.
This is what he was saying. And it was true, because whenever we were really hard up, something would come along and solve the difficulty for the moment.
Was your mother a good housekeeper?
Oh, very. I don't know. She managed with all us kids and yet never got into debt. I can never understand it. Because... I don't get into debt because I don't. I'm against it, because it's harder to get out of debt than to get into it.
Yeah.
So as far as possible, I've always followed what she taught me. She was a first class cook too, and
she could make something out of nothing in a way.
A matter of threepence or fourpence, we'd have a big pot full of soup and that sort. And she used to make oatmeal dumplings with currants and raisins and onions and all sorts. And well, that was a filler, if you like. But we liked it. It was tasty, you see. She used to make all sorts of things like that. And of course, this was of use to me when I went into service and had to do the cooking as well as the other work.
She trained you in housework, the children?
In housework, yeah. Mm. One of the things... which all my sisters remember this, it's no good you scrubbing the middle of the floor, get into the corners under the bed there, and she'd see you dead. You could eat from under the bed, never mind in the middle of the floor. But
so she was a good wife to him, really?
Oh, yes, oh, yes. They were very much attached to one another. They used to hug one another when they were over 70. Dad would go up and fold her in his arms. You know, that was an object lesson to the rest of us. Funny, all my brothers and sisters married happily.
Everyone's probably connected, you know, isn't
there? Yeah, there is a connection.
Yeah.
But you
haven't said anything about your house. Did you say one house in Glasgow then when you moved there, or did you move around a lot?
We didn't move around a lot, but the street I was talking about, Roland Street, was a tenement. It was a new street, of course. Mm. In those days, they didn't allow you to go into a new house until it was 12 months old. But nowadays, they go in when they're finished, 2 weeks after the workmen are finished.
So it was his own house? He bought the house?
Oh, no, we didn't buy houses. No, we didn't have the money to buy houses.
I see. So you rented it, did he?
We rented it, and then when we moved further into the middle of Glasgow, I've never owned a house because I've moved around so much. I've gone abroad.
Well, anyway, it was less common in those days, wasn't it?
It was very much less common. Mm. And some of my brothers and sisters, of course, they own their own houses, you see.
Oh, now, I'm sure
now,
they do.
But in those days, it was an unheard of
thing.
But
you must have had quite a big house for a family of 10, didn't you?
Oh, yeah. Well, we had, in those days, we had four rooms, you see. Well, so they meant the boy slept in the big room and the girl slept in the other room, and they were in the kitchen, Dad and Mother slept. But you know, in Scotland they have beds in the kitchen, and they're part of the house itself. There's a recess in the kitchen, and you see a double bed. It's on boards in it.
Oh, sorry, it's all right.
Okay. Boards, you see, and so you put your mattress on top of the boards, and that sort of thing. Of course, now they've got spring mattresses and all the rest of it. But then it was straw palliasses, and then they'd kick on top of that, so that your parents slept in the kitchen. And
you've only said three rooms now. What was the fourth room?
Well, the fourth room was what we called the parlour.
I see. So you went there on special occasions.
Yes. Well, if Dad was making clothes, he kept his machine in there for any of us. He would use that to make suits and frocks and things
like that. So it was almost like a little workroom as well.
It was always like a little workroom.
It's incredible, just four rooms for a family of 12.
Yes, that's
incredible,
right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Incredible. So you must have had a happy time, didn't you? It must have been great fun being brought up in a family.
This is what people can't understand today. I said, you know, we were all happy. I said, this is why we've grown up in affection for one another. We do respect one another, and we do love one another. I said, but I said, well, I don't understand the sort of friction that goes on in families today. I said, there were this big crowd of us.
Because you had to, in a way, didn't you? You were so crammed together. If it would have been really difficult.
Yes. But as I say, apart from silly childish quarrels, which even in the best regulated, we never really sulked with one another. And of course, Dad wouldn't have stood for that anyway. He said, come on, make it up. Don't be sulking with one another. And sure enough.
Was he a teetotaler?
Yes. And a non-smoker.
Was he? Well, on principle, really.
On principle, yes. Mm. On principle.
Because that type of high principle working man very often is a person who doesn't go into a pub, isn't he? And
won't go into a pub. Mm. And, of course, as I say, all our MPs in the 1922 election, when they talked about the Red Clyde Act, every one of our Scottish members, north and south in Scotland, west and east, were all teetotalers, total abstainers, everyone. Mm. That's unusual. Mm. And we, of course, in England, the miners, the local priests, people like that, they were in the, of course, Methodists were more or less teetotal, as you know. So that the movement was founded on sound principles, as far as that's concerned.
What did he actually do in the ILP then? Was he an official locally?
Well, he was chairman of the branch. When I was 16, I became vice chairman. Because I couldn't join till I was 16, you see. And they made me vice chair. I think it's because of my dad had been so successful in the chair. So, and we had a big branch there too.
So he stayed chairman, what, for a long time?
Oh, yes, and then somebody else took over. I never became chairman because I moved away.
But he never stood for Parliament or anything like that?
Oh, no, no, but he was very proud because I stood for Parliament. I did a lot of freelance journalism because I couldn't find a job because of being an agitator.
Yes, you've been so interesting about your parents, I haven't got on to you, but let's get on to you now, shall we? I mean, you don't start off in the women's movement, you start off in the Labour movement.
In the Labour movement, you? Yes.
Yeah.
Well, because of my interest in the Labour movement, when the WSNPU formed a branch in Glasgow, I thought, this is for me. Because, you see, I was interested in, I've always been interested in the women's movement, still am. In fact, I'm trustee for the Battered Wives Homes in Bristol here, which is a voluntary movement. Mm. And I think I've been in every agitation for women's rights since that age, since I was 16. Well, I joined this branch, and there were a lot of middle-class women in it, but there were also a tremendous number of working-class women. Mm. Now, you may have seen Shoulder to Shoulder, that document.
Yes, I have, yes.
Well, I think this gives a distorted picture, because you would seem to think that the only working woman there was Annie Kenney,
yeah.
And all the rest were middle class or upper middle class. Well, there were a lot of them. There were the daughters of the aristocracy as well. But we had a tremendous number of ordinary working women. And the point of this is that when, I forget the actual year, I think it was 1910, we were going to, they had a working women's deputation, yes it would be 1910 because I was only 17 at the time, we had a working women's deputation to lobby Parliament about this business of votes for women. Mm-hmm. Well now, deputations of 12 came from all the big cities in the country. Working women. Mm. They had to be working women. They had to be middle class or upper middle class.
Yeah.
And when we got to London, there was this huge crowd of women, working women.
You were on the deputation yourself?
I was the youngest, of course. The other women were twice and one case three times my age. But we were a united group, all right. And they were genuinely good women. Some of them were, like myself, members of the ILP or the Clarion group, you know, Robert Blatchford's paper. And we went up, but we were marching peaceably over Westminster Bridge there.
Mm.
And the Mail and some of the other papers had incited the bully boys to turn out and break up our demonstration. Or our march, rather. And so they set upon us, I did wear a hat there, I haven't worn one for 60 years, but I did wear a hat then. It's torn off my hair, and I had a lot of hair in those days, very thick, and pulling out by the handful. Torn my coat, and generally made me look like a rag bag of vanity. And the police were there, mind you. And they never moved a finger to stop it.
Were they organised, these roughs, do you think?
Oh, yes. They were. It was, the Daily Mail was always doing this kind of thing, and the other capitalist papers, they were always doing this kind of thing, even if we'd have a peace march or an adult suffrage march. It was always the same. They incited. I can remember an occasion when we were having a meeting, a peace meeting in Southgate Church in London in the First World War. And all the national papers in London advertised the fact, and calling us all sorts of names, pro-German and what have you. Well, there's no more pro-German than I am now. I was simply a socialist. They broke into the church while we were having this service, poured petrol all up the aisle, poured it in the organ loft, and set fire, so we had to move out. And there they were beating us up. People who would never raise a hand against anybody. And this is all due to the press.
But how did they? How did you know they'd organise it? Was it just that you saw the paper beforehand?
Oh yes, it was advertised in the press.
Yes, I see.
They gave whole columns about this group of so and so's.
Mm.
You know, all the names they could think of to describe pacifists, and they still do it. Just like they say, every socialist government is a Marxist government. When they probably none of the members of the government ever read Marx.
But how did you, getting back to how you got joined up the other time, how old were you when you actually joined then?
Well, I was just between 16 and 17.
At the same time as you joined the ILP?
I joined the ILP.
Mm.
And this WSBU branch was quite strong, and we were very active holding outdoor meetings.
It was the Glasgow branch.
It was the Glasgow branch.
Yes.
We had some very good women there. Teresa Billington Gregor was very...
Oh, now tell me about her, because I'm very interested in her. I've talked to her daughter, actually.
Yeah.
What was she like then?
Oh, she really was a very fine, even orator, I would call her. And she was well-versed in all the arguments against women's rights. She could floor an opponent. Just by answering his silly question, because very often the questions were silly, like the one that Mary Gawthorpe got by one head. Wouldn't you like to be a man? And she retorted like a flash, yes, wouldn't you?
Yes, I've heard that one. She was very good, wasn't she?
She was very witty. Oh, there were other women just as witty too. They had a lot of very cultured women there, and also women who knew how to answer the hecklers.
Did you ever come across Helen Fraser?
I can't remember. The name sounds familiar to me.
She was active in Scotland, but maybe a little before your time. I just wondered if you remember the name.
Well, I knew quite a few of them in Scotland, you see, because we used to meet in the St Andrews Hall at our demonstrations. They came from, there was I think Agnes Husband from Dundee.
Yes, I heard that name.
And then there was Janie Allen, the ship owner's sister.
Yes, yes.
And, there are quite a number of them. Their names, if they were mentioned to me, I should remember them.
Yes.
Then there were, in England, there was Flora Drummond
Well, she was the organiser,
working woman, all right.
But can you actually remember your first meeting, going along to your first WSPU meeting? I mean,
it was held in a shop which we had rented for the purposes of this play, you see. It's somewhere near Sahi Hall Street, I just forget where, but anyway, we had quite a crowd there, and that was unusual for a meeting just starting up, and practically everybody joined then and there, and we were all told that we got to make our contribution as far as we were able, and to sell literature, and to do propaganda in our, you know, in a quiet way, if we weren't speakers and so on. And even to take part in the raids on the postal pillarboxes, which meant just dropping a bottle of acid, taking the cork out and dropping the acid into the box.
Did you do that?
Oh, yes.
Did you really? How was that organised? Tell me how it was organised. What happened?
Well, you see, it was organised in quite military precision, with military precision. We met in this place, and we were all handed our tools, the balls of acid or whatever it was we had to do, and we were told the time that we got to drop this in, the exact moment we got to drop it in, and we covered the whole city of Glasgow in that way, and nobody was ever caught, because the thing was done at different times, you see. So if we did it at 6 o'clock one night, well, then we wouldn't choose that 6 o'clock, because they'd be looking for us at 6 o'clock. We'd perhaps do it at 8 o'clock, or perhaps earlier, you see, this is how. And I can't remember a single occasion when any one of us was caught.
Who prepared the acid then? Where did you get that from?
Well, one of the women who was a scientist, a chemist, she used to get these bottles of acid for us. We had all sorts of professional women, you see, who were able to help us in a thousand different ways. We know the only time any of our women were caught when it was a window smashing thing. Well, being in service, I couldn't very well go out on that, but I could drop acid into a pillow box without anybody suspecting that this girl in the muslin apron and black dress and cap and cuffs could be doing anything criminal.
So it was all simultaneous, really, was it? That is, you all collected at one point, collected your acid.
Yeah, we all collected, and then went away.
Went off and dropped it simultaneously in the boxes.
Yes.
And then went off on your business.
Went off
you were
on
going.
Our business, yes. They never caught one of us all that time.
But what about acid, getting acid on your hands, for instance?
Well, of course, we didn't pull the cork out until we were actually dropping it into the pillar box.
Because it could be quite dangerous. I don't know what the acid was, actually. Was it?
Well, it was a burning acid, anyway. I don't know what it was, vitriol or what it was, but I can't remember. But I know that I had only gone up to where I was employed when I could see smoke coming out of the pillar box.
Did any of the members object to doing that? I mean, interfering with other people's letters?
Oh, some of them would. Well, in that case, they refused to take on the job, you see. But they'd never give us away.
No,
I wouldn't do that.
So you could choose whether you wanted to do that.
You could choose whether you wanted to do it or not. And of course, some took on more dangerous tasks, like setting castles on fire. And none of our group did that, but... This was discussed too, going into political meetings and shouting their heads off and being.
Did you ever do that yourself, actually?
Oh yes, because the one way to disconcert a speaker is always to shout in the middle of his oratory. It does this. I know from my own experience that I can do that.
So who did you break up then?
Oh, I was some Tory MP. Well, there were two of them actually, but. They didn't take long to throw me out, so.
Because they had a system, didn't they, where you had numbers and one person interrupted, number one interrupted,
yeah,
and then when
right.
number one had been done, number two, and so on. Did that work? Was that how it was done when you did it?
That's how it was done. Even the students in Glasgow University, they did this, so they copied from us, and they started interrupting our meetings like that. But I got some dockers in to help us then, because both being in the trade union socialist movement, I was able to speak to them. These dockers, I don't know if they believed in women's suffrage or not, but I told them that we were going to have our demonstration in St Andrews all broken up. I said, leave it to us, Jesse, we'll see that it's all right. Well, on the night, the place was packed, and these students dotted themselves in different places. But these dockers were all standing against the wall, you see. And when the meeting started, then one of these students got up, two or three of them would shout at once, and immediately these dockers moved in. One docker could lift two of them out of their seats. You can see what big men they were, and throw them down the steps. 50 of them went into a hospital, I believe. But they had them out in 10 minutes in spite of this, you know, this business of number two, number three, number four, five. They had them out within 10 minutes and the meeting went on. But one time when Mrs. Pankhurst came, she was out on leave, you know, under what we call the Cat and Mouse Act, temporary release of prisons. Of course, they couldn't keep her in because she would have died, so they had to let her out after two or three weeks. And she'd have served a 2-year sentence. I doubt if she served 6 months of it. But anyway, she was speaking for us this night, and it was well advertised, the meeting, and there were police on the roof of the building, police all round, police in the corridors, and then when the meeting started at 7:30, TM got up, she says, I'm delighted, ladies, to tell you that our respected leader is here, our much-loved leader, Emmeline Pankhurst, who is now going to speak. Well, we had the front of the platform all covered in bunting, but under the bunting was barbed wire. And we had flower pots and all sorts as well. And when she got up, police, they were staggered for a minute, and then they came rushing forward to the platform. They were pulling on this bunting, and of course they got their hands. And then one woman had a revolver which she was using, in which she was using blank shot, throwing pots and all sorts. And there was a real pandemonium. And then they were leading Mrs. Pankhurst off the platform. We wore long skirts in those days. And the woman who was leading her off tripped, you see, and she pulled Mrs. Pankhurst, so they got her. But what mystified the police and everybody else was how she managed to get in, with all those police watching outside and inside the building. Well, actually, she'd been there all the afternoon. She'd come in with a corporation basket of laundry, you know, clean linen. Since she'd been lying there all the time till it was time for the meeting next.
Did you ever talk to Mrs. Pankhurst yourself?
Oh, yes. I talked to all of them. I worked for Sylvia in the East End of London, you
Did
see,
you
for
really?
Years, even after the... During the war and the First World War, I'm talking
Did you
about.
Really?
Yeah. And she had a big following of working women.
Oh, she did, yes.
Yeah,
she did.
A very big following. And I was going around the country forming branches of what we call the Workers' Suffrage Federation, adult suffrage.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that. They were only asking for votes for women on the same basis as men.
That's right.
In the WSPU.
That's right.
What did your father think about that? Because the Labour movement was connected with adult suffrage, really, wasn't it?
Yes, that's... Oh, he was quite in favour. He says they've got to start somewhere. He was very liberal-minded about these things.
Yes.
There's some things he didn't agree with, like burning places down and slashing pictures. Well,
yes.
That was a bit of vandalism that a lot of us didn't much care about, but still, these women were prepared to go to jail for it.
But you never had arguments with your parents about it then? They supported you, really?
No. In fact, my dad has come to me with meetings, come with me to the meetings to listen to the speakers. No, he was very much in advance of his age. I have no doubt about that. Even when I formed the Domestic Workers Union, he was very active helping me there, and helped me to organise dances for them and all that sort of thing.
Why were the students so hostile to women's suffrage in Glasgow?
Well, this was just one of those, you know, getting a kick out of it, as they say nowadays. They had no opinions one way or the other. It's just that they were out for mischief, and women were easy targets, as they saw it.
It was just a bit of fun, really.
It was just a bit of fun. It wasn't really because they were anti-suffrage. They didn't care a hang whether we were for suffrage or against it. They just were out for a night's fun. That was often the case in those days. Among university students, especially in Glasgow, and in other parts of the country too. They go to a theatre and act the goat there, you see, although it wasn't because they didn't like the play, or just because they wanted a night out.
That's interesting, yes, because one might easily get that wrong. What's surprising, you see, is now the students would be in favour of things, wouldn't they?
Very much so.
It's changed, really, on that.
Well,
I've come
across some of these girls I've been to speak to, the students' club in Bristol here, and the daughters of wealthy industrialists come up and say to me, and they fully agreed with what I was saying.
That is a difference.
That's the difference. They're very much more progressive and tolerant than they were in those days, because we had to put up with all sorts.
What about your mother? Did you get your mother to join the WSPU?
No, mother was too gentle for that sort of thing. She didn't mind me doing it, but in fact, when anybody said anything about me being in the suffrage movement, she says, "Well, if she feels that's right, that's her right to do what she feels right." She says, "I'm not interfering with, neither is her father." So that was the answer they got. No, I'm glad we had such tolerant parents, because they certainly were.
Did you ever sell papers in the street?
Oh yes, many times. Many times, especially when there was a meeting in the hall, I'd be outside selling papers to anybody who cared to. I used to be a good saleswoman.
Did you shout, votes for women or whatever it was?
Yes, votes for women, and the name of the paper too, you see.
Yes, you'd sell votes for women.
I'd sell it, it was interesting, because being so young, I got more people coming up to buy the paper than if I'd been older.
Did you get people insulting you or being rude?
Usually the people who were rude were women. It wasn't so much men as women in those days. Well, men were too, of course, but it was women who were the bitchy ones. Because they thought we were lowering their standards. The gentle creatures. Incidentally, it's curious, but the people who were attacking the women's liberation movement, they are far more aggressive than any woman's liberator I've ever met. Mm. Yeah, they really are. The language they use.
These were upper class women who'd attack you, would they really?
Yes.
What sort of things would they say? I mean.
They'd say, "What? You get back into your proper place. Coming out in public, making an exhibition of yourself," all this sort of thing. Mm. Of course, that never worried me, because I'm a fighter by nature, you see.
Because another problem about street selling was getting splashed with mud and stuff.
And that was deliberate, of course. Mm. That was deliberate. That was definitely too.
You mean people actually drove past close to you?
Where there was a pool of water and mud, and do it deliberately. Oh, yes. Mm. That happened to me many times, but not that it...
Because streets in those days were much dirtier, weren't they?
Oh, dirtier and ruts everywhere, you see. The roads are much better kept today, even although in this street it's not as good as it should be.
Mm.
But that's because of all the repairs that have been done by the gas company and the stormwater drainage scheme that we have here. I mean, this road has been up more times than I
can. Because that matters to you, I think, does it?
Well, it doesn't matter to me, because I've got to be careful when I'm feeling my way along the pavement, you see, whether...
Oh, pavements. What about pavement chalking? Did you do that?
Oh, yes.
Chalking meetings and things?
Oh, yes, I did a lot of that. In fact, I was hauled up for disfiguring the pavement once, but they didn't hold it against me. They let me go. But I suppose it was just to frighten me. But that never frightened anybody, because they couldn't do anything about you chalking on the pavement on the road.
Because the trouble was, you might get kicked up the backside, might you, while you were doing it. That was one of the dangers, wasn't
it? Yes, that was one of the dangers. But of course, that never actually happened. But they were very rude about it.
Mm.
And they would try to rub out what you had done.
But did you just sort of worked behind the scenes in the branch? You didn't actually speak in public, did you? Or did you?
I did speak, but I wasn't a very good speaker at that time.
Because you'd started speaking in the IOB. Well,
in the IOB, yes,
I suppose, didn't you?
Yes, really? And when I formed the Domestic Workers Union, I had to speak there. And I must say the Glasgow papers were very complimentary to this young girl who stated her case calmly and without emotion.
Yes, I'm just wondering, where were you trained really for the domestic union work? Would you attribute it to the WSPU speaking or to the ILP speaking or both, really?
Oh, both, because I got experience from both of them, you see. Yes. And then again in London, when I joined Sylvia Pankhurst, I got a lot of practice there.
Yes, of course.
We had to go out and canvass for members and speak in the parts. We got up to all sorts of tricks to attract a crowd.
But, can you remember your first public speaking, first occasion? Were you very nervous?
I was very nervous the first time I got up. I was, my knees were wobbling. But I kept on and... I didn't stand up for very long. I think it was about 5 or 10 minutes.
That was for the WSPU, was it, or for the ILP?
No, it was for the WSPU.
Was it? Yeah.
Yes, but as I went on, I got more and more confidence.
Because that's one of the things it does. It gets people out speaking, doesn't it? And that's terribly important for their later development, isn't it?
I think so. I've done a lot of teaching of public speaking for the old NCLC. Which of course now is the TUC Education Trust. Mm. We did an awful lot of that kind of work. Voluntary tutors, you see, didn't get paid for it, but you took these groups every week for a couple of hours. Mm. And in fact, I trained people for the City Council in Bristol.
That's right.
Yes, I ran a discussion group on a Sunday morning. And
so you had a good voice, really. I mean, you had a carrying voice.
I had a very strong... A strong, caring voice. I didn't need a microphone. A lot of people use microphones would be better without them. Yeah. Because they shout through them, whereas you only need an ordinary conversational voice when you're in front of a microphone. Mm. I learned that when I first did a BBC broadcast years and years ago.
But just to get the sort of the times right, time of your career right, you carried on in Glasgow WSPU and ILP till the First War, did you? When did you go to London?
I went to London it'd be about 1912, I suppose.
Oh, before the war, did you?
Mm. Oh, it was before the war.
I see. Mm.
But I'd formed this domestic workers' union, and I was fairly successful with it because the girls said, oh, we want something like that.
When was that? Sorry to interrupt you, I just don't know your history. You know, you actually started forming the Domestic Workers' Union in Glasgow, actually, you went to London.
Before I went to London.
What, about 1911?
I wasn't 17 then.
Good Lord, you started as early as
that? Yeah, as early as that.
Good heavens.
And
that off? How did you start that?
Well, there was some correspondence in one of the local papers about the conditions in domestic service, loneliness and things like that. Mm. And it could be very lonely for a young girl, you see. Mm. And I was in a house where there were two of us, you see, so it wasn't too bad. But later I went to one with four. Mm. I was all right in that first place because they were kind people, and although the wages weren't a lot, our food was good, and we shared with the family, you know, the meals that were sent up to the table. But it was when I went to the second place that I got the most response. I started when I was in the first place, but didn't get much response at that time. But when this correspondence arose, of course, I immediately seized on it. I wrote a letter myself and even said that a meeting would be held in the Christian Institute in Vaudeville Street, Glasgow, on such and such a night. And really, I was amazed. The place was packed out. And they were even out in the hall onto the pavement even. And there I was, up there with all these girls in front of me, and I stated I'd made a few notes, you see, so I wouldn't lose my place, and told them what we were out of. And they received it with enthusiasm. I think we recruited about 200. Anyway, there was a lot of criticism that the mistresses hadn't been represented, so I wrote to the paper and said I'd arranged another meeting for employers only. And that meeting was back too. And they tried to, although I was so young and I had so little experience, the questions they asked, I could answer easily because I knew the answers before they asked them. I knew the kind of questions they would put. And the Glasgow Herald the next day said that they were amazed at the capacity I showed to answer fully the questions by people who are hostile to me. So, she didn't lose her temper, said the Glasgow Herald. She kept on as sweetly as answering these questions.
So it really grew like a mushroom in a way.
It grew like a mushroom.
Very quickly.
Yes, and as a result of that, we got 2 hours off every day for our members, you know, free time, because we used to only get one afternoon or evening a week, and every second Sunday. So that, and we demanded that all uniform should be paid for by the employer, because we didn't see why we should be paying for our uniform out of our wages every month. Mm. And Oh, we made a lot of progress. We even went to the Earl of Mar's place near Dollar, and we got his maids in.
It must be very difficult unionising in such a fragmented profession as that.
Oh, very,
it? I mean,
very
it's a peculiarly difficult.
Difficult
one,
yes, it's like clerical workers in one or two offices where the only staff is one or two. It's very difficult. It's when you get into the big combinations that you make progress. And I found in the big houses we did better than in the small ones.
Yeah, I can understand that, because there's less personal contact in the big houses with the employer, isn't
that's
there?
That's right.
Really?
Yes, so we had a great... But, of course, that led to me getting the sack.
What, from where you had, where there were four people, you mean?
Yes, that's right. And then she
did
said...
Did it really? What did she say? How did
she said she wasn't having agitators in her house. She didn't believe in trade unions. And, she didn't want anybody in her house that was doing this kind of thing. It was disloyal to the employer and all this sort of thing. So she gave me a month's notice.
You did your job well, did you? I mean, she had no complaint.
Oh, no, no complaint about my work at all. In fact, she gave me quite a good reference. I've always had good references because I've always been conscientious, like all good trade unionists should be. Well, this is how I view it, and that's how all the old trade unionists used to view it too. Sliding into the powder room as some of them do for 20 minutes to smoke a fag or powder their noses and things like that. We never did things like that.
So, this union you formed, was it a branch of a national union, or were you founding a new union?
It was a new union. We'd never had a union in Scotland before then. Oh.
But how did you get any help then, getting this launched? Because it was a big responsibility.
Well, I formed a committee of about a dozen girls, and they were all girls who were very intelligent. Well, they had to be to join the union, I should say. But they helped me a lot, and they made contributions apart from our very small sub of 3 apes a week. Yes, that's right, 3 apes a week. But they used to give me half sovereigns and 5 shillings and things like that for the publicity. And we had a magistrate in Glasgow, Bailey Alston, a Labour man, who was also, he gave us the use of his tea rooms for our meetings free of charge. And we had 2 or 3 Glasgow councillors who helped us as well. He used to come and speak to our meetings. And
was there a tie-up between the union and the WSPU, or was it quite separate?
Oh, it was quite separate. It was quite separate. But, of course, the experience I got in the WSPU was invaluable when it came to this other job too, because, you see, I had experience in public speaking, you see, which was a help. But later on, they had a union in London called the Domestic Workers Union of Great Britain and Ireland.
Oh, yes.
And
so did you affiliate to that then? Or?
Yes, I got in touch with them and we affiliated. And later when I went to London, I was on their national executive.
I see. So it was really a sort of local union, springing up from the ground, but when it had grown up, then joined up with what you discovered was a national...
A national organisation, yes, which was much better from any point of view. And there's some very good women in that London union, very good indeed. Well, several of them were also suffragettes.
Were they really?
Yes, that was curious, because when they heard that I was a member of the WSPU, I was welcomed with open arms.
So there really is a connection.
There is a connection, yes. Yeah. And
But you said your WSPU experience was very useful in organising the union. How, really? What sort of...
Well, you see how a meeting is run. You see how the standing orders are set up. You see how the procedure goes along during a meeting. And, of course, if you've only been at a meeting and never taken part in it before, it's something that you take in as you go, you see, especially when you've something else in mind that you're going to run yourself.
Yes. So it really was useful to you?
Always useful. I learned all sorts of things from different organisations I belonged to as the years have rolled by.
Because there must have been a lot of help from the ILP as well, I suppose.
That's it. You see, I've told you about these dockers. And,
yes.
And then, of course, Keir Hardie came to to Glasgow for an ILP meeting, and he devoted his talk entirely to the need for equal suffrage, you see.
Yes.
And votes for women. He made that quite clear. The Labour Party was always in favour of that, right, from the beginning. There might be one or two of the, what you call, liberal apps, because we had them at one time, and then they disappeared after...
Like John Burns, people like that.
Yes, they all disappeared after 1906, when we got 46 Labour people into the House of Commons for the first time.
I'm worried. You've got yourself sacked now.
Yes.
What did you do then?
Well, I managed to get one or two other jobs where I was the only maid, and there were, they wanted somebody with experience, and one of them was an artist, Scottish artist, David Gold. But my bed was in the kitchen, so you had to shut the door when they came into the kitchen, so they didn't see the bed. But some of these, this place where there were four girls, by the way, they had two baths, two bathrooms, but we weren't allowed to use the baths. Oh no, we had to go in the wash house and have our bath in the copper, warm the water and then get into the copper when the girls opened the door, so any of the men who might pass through couldn't get in. It's not for humiliation which servants had to suffer in those.
As if you were different creatures.
As if we were different creatures. Yeah, we were often very much cleaner than they were from because we were always taught to be clean. Every one of us had a bath every week. My mother saw to that. And we had one of those old-fashioned lead-lined baths, you know.
Oh, yes.
Of course, you could pour the water in there because the lead wouldn't let the water seep through to the wood underneath.
Mm. But you had a number of individual jobs. What made you go to London then, Stephen?
Well, when they became too hot for me, in Glasgow, and as soon as they heard my name, they wouldn't look at me. There was only one place where I could be sure of having a job, and that was my McAlpine nursing home. They were always wanting somebody temporarily, and they would always get in touch with me and ask me if I was still working or if I'd let a temporary job. So I could always fill in my time while I was waiting, you see. But I thought, well, it's about time I departed from here, because it's getting more and more difficult to get a job. So I wrote up to Grace Neal, who was General Secretary of the Domestic Workers Union in London. I asked her if she had any places, because they ran an employment agency as well, you see.
Oh yes, I see.
For people who would take girls belonging to the union.
Yes.
I asked her if she had any places in London. She wrote back and said, come away, we'll put you up for a day or two. Well, we can find you a place, all right. We've no trouble about that. We've more places than we can fill. So I went up there, stayed with one of the members of the executive for two or three days, and then I went to a place in Purley where I had union conditions. I had a lovely bedroom, properly furnished, and there were two daughters, two teenage daughters, and the man was the employer. Was a bank manager. So.
Oh yes. Mm.
So they were middle class, good middle class stock, you see. But they used to come into my kitchen and talk to me and help me in if they could.
Mm.
I really enjoyed being in that place. I stayed with them until they had to move to Herne Bay. He had got a more important job, you see.
So you really went to London not to engage in politics particularly,
get a job. That really was what I was after, and that's all I was concerned about. But that was the first job I ever had that really I enjoyed having. The first one I did, because they were kind people, but you get into so many of these others who think that servants are a lower breed.
Yes.
And
But did you actually want to go to London anyway? Were you a rather adventurous girl?
I had intended one day to go to London. Mm. My dad wasn't so keen because he thought I was too young to be later on my own.
It must have been a bit of worry for
you. Yes, it was a worry. I know it was a worry to him, but I went and he said, well, I won't help you. They go, I won't give you money for your fare. But dear mother, she says, I'll pay your fare, but don't you say anything to anybody. Don't tell anybody I went. I says, right, mother, I'll send it back to you as soon as I get it. Because I knew I'd get it as I went to London, I'd get the money back, you see. And I paid it back all right, but nobody ever knew that mother gave me that money. I kept her secret.
well, that's very interesting. Yeah. So, anyway, when you got to London, I suppose that widened your horizon a lot.
Oh, yes, they wanted me then to go into Hyde Park and places like that, Finsbury Park, and speak up for the domestic servants. We used to get very, very good meetings then. We didn't have any disturbance. There was nobody who really, except perhaps some middle class individual come along and start being asking silly questions. Of course, he got silly answer. But like poor old Tom Anderson, who used to speak in Finsbury Park, somebody said to him, why do all you Scots always sound your hearts like that? He says, if you're not careful, I'll come down and kick you. Oh, he was funny. He always had an answer. He had everybody roaring.
But when you went to London then, did you give up the WSPU and work just for the Servants' Union?
I kept in touch with Sylvia Pankhurst, you see, because
she
in the East End of London, because I was more interested in the work she was doing anyway.
I was going to say, because you see, she formed the East London Federation, didn't
she? That's right.
About 1913.
That's correct.
And that split off from the WSPU, didn't it?
Oh, it was split off, yes.
Did you disagree with the WSPU then?
Well, I did, because when the war started, they all went patriotic.
Oh, yes, they did, yes. But
yes.
Even before then, the East London Federation broke off.
Oh, they broke off
before
because
the war.
Yes, because they said they didn't think that they were fully engaged in the fight for women's rights.
That's right. Mm.
And that was,
so you went along with Sylvia?
I went along with Sylvia on that.
That's
because as a socialist I felt I had to.
Yes.
But all that crowd, Dacre Fox and the Pankers, not Sylvia of course, Flora Drummond, she formed the Guild of Empire, wanted me to become an organiser.
Can you tell me about Mrs. Dacre Fox? She's a person I don't know much about, but she was very prominent towards the end, wasn't she?
Oh, yes.
What sort of woman was she, actually?
Well, she was a professional woman, middle class. I don't know what she was actually in profession, but...
Yes.
Because she was a very, very, very good speaker, you know, fine speaker, and very effective too.
Because she got tied up with the fascist movement later.
Well, this was it, you see. Well, first she got tied up with the war movement, you see, and then she got tied up with Mosley and his crowd. And I can remember Mosley coming to the ILP. He became a member of the ILP. And in 1924, I was at a conference where they put him on that panel of parliamentary candidates. And I was in a private session. I was against it at the time. I said, this man's no good to us. He's done nothing for us. I said, he won't do any good for us in the long run. But I was voted down. And I says, well, you'll be sorry for it.
Within 6 years or so.
8 years it was. 1932, we formed the...
British Union of Fascists.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, and John Strachey joined him he gave him up, of course, because he had no sympathy with that sort of thing. But this is the sort of thing that was happening at the time. All sorts of strange people were coming into our movement. But Mrs. Dacre Fox, of course, she came to Glasgow 2-3 times.
Did she?
Yes. But during the war, she came to Bermondsey, where I was working. And before I left Sylvia, see, to go to Bermondsey.
Yes.
And I was working for Dr. Salter, who
yes, yes.
later became MP
yes.
for Bermondsey.
I went to work for him in the ILP there, and was seconded to the National Federation of Women Workers to help build up their organisation in the southeast of London.
You've done just about everything, haven't you? Really interesting. And why they weren't? I mean, could we just get back to the WSPU in London? Did you actually go to any meetings in London?
Oh yes, I went to their demonstrations. We went to the Albert Hall. Mm. In fact, at one time I was in their choir.
You weren't in the bodyguard, were you? In the
Oh no, I was a steward, but I was never in the bodyguard. No. Mm. They had women who understood jiu-jitsu in that.
Yes, well, you needed it, didn't you?
Oh, you did. You did. One of my colleagues in Bermondsey was an old suffragette, and she'd been in Liverpool, and she was only about she wasn't 5 foot nothing. She was just under 5 foot, but she was a good organiser. She worked under me, and during the suffragette campaign, the police set about these women, to move them on. And this policeman came up to a big, hefty fella, 6 foot something, and he tried to grab her, and he went over her head. And of course, she was arrested, and when she was taken to court, the magistrate couldn't believe it. You see, this tiny woman and this big man. So he asked for the well of the court to be cleared so he could have a demonstration. Never thinking it was possible. She did it again. And he only gave her a month. They usually gave him a lot more. He only gave her a month.
But
I went to all their demonstrations and
did you? Yes.
And still went to sold their literature if I was at their meetings.
Because in a way, the WSPU in London was much more active than it was in
in the provinces. Oh, very much more so. Yeah.
Because it was really the headquarters.
It was really the headquarters, and they were always organising something.
Yes.
They did all sorts of things that we would never have thought of in the provinces. And chaining themselves to the railings and the Houses of Commons, and even going into Churchill's meeting and kicking up around there.
You kept out of trouble, did you, rather, in London, or what did you feel?
I was in service at first, so I had to be careful, because I'd had so much victimisation in Glasgow, I couldn't afford to start all over again in London.
No.
But so far as my activities in East London and in Bermondsey, I was always very prominent there.
Yes, let's get on to East London. So you joined the East London Federation, I suppose?
Yes, that's right.
Where were you then? Still in Purley, or had you moved?
No, I'd moved. No, they'd gone to Herne Bay, you see.
I see, yes.
So they wanted me to go there with them, but I thought, oh no, I can't do that, because I shan't be able to be active in the union if I go there. Anyway, I went to Sylvia's place, and
well, that's in Bow, isn't it?
In Bow, yes. Yeah. Well, she had a creche for babies as well.
That's
She had this factory, soft toys, you see.
Did you ever come across Miss Lagsting? Is it Elsie Lagsting?
I might have done. There were a lot. There was Nora Smythe and this.
Yes, I just wondered if you had, because I've met her.
I probably did. Mm.
Anyway, you went to see Sylvia.
Yes.
And,
well, she took me on and appointed me a national organiser, so.
Did she?
Yes.
For the East London Federation?
Yes, I went to open branches in the provinces, in Yorkshire and Lancashire. And they weren't very big branches, but they were sales points, so to speak, so
yes.
They were worth having.
Yes.
And I was quite successful in that way, and then I went to Doncaster, went to Burnley, went to Preston,
that now during the war or before the war?
That was during the war.
Yes, I
see. During the war.
Yeah.
I was able to establish one in Preston. A businesswoman there said that she would like to take on the job, and she did, and she formed a branch there.
But this was a full-time thing, was it?
Oh,
then? I mean,
yes,
you didn't
I was
do
getting 30
service,
a week for that.
Were you really, yes?
Aye, and 28 of it went to landladies, and sometimes I didn't get my wages for 2 or 3 weeks. So what I had to do then was to go out and hold an open-air meeting
and take a collection and credit it against my wages. I did that very often when I was working for Sylvia.
Tell me about Sylvia. What sort of person was she?
Well, she was a bit of a dreamer in some respects. You know, she wasn't really businesslike or practical. But when it came to the journalism, her paper, she really was good.
That's the Dreadnought, isn't it?
Yeah, the Dreadnought. Yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah. That was a very good paper. And it was very well produced, you see, considering the shortage of cash and so on. We used to sell thousands of those all over the country.
So you take those with you when you went to...
Yeah, everywhere I went, I used to take a bundle with me. Mm. And I was always determined never to come back with any in my leftover. In fact, we had a calendar for 1 year, and it was to be sold at sixpence. And then while we were on the road, she actually wrote and said she wanted it sold for a shilling. Well, I knew I'd never get rid of mine like that, 500 a shilling. Not in those days. So I went on selling for sixpence. I was the only one who got rid of all my calendar.
But she was was she a person who was able to attract your loyalty? Did she?
Oh yes. Those girls, they worshipped her. Those working factory girls, they worshipped her. Mm. And you think of those women who were close to her, like Nora Smythe and Miss Callaghan, several others that worked with her at the time. They were absolutely devoted to her.
How did she do it then, if she wasn't very well organised? Why were they devoted to her?
Well, I think they loved her for herself. Although she was a bit autocratic like her mother, but I don't know. They seem to forget this because they admired her for her spirit and the work she'd done in the suffrage movement. Mm. Because most of these women who were close to her have been active suffragists like herself, you see. Mm. So that she always had this loyalty. Later on, of course, she married, well, she didn't marry him, she lived with him.
An Italian chap.
Italian chap.
Yeah.